Hi everyone. This is John Mandrola, and I'm excited to be with a assistant professor, Dina. Dina, say your last name.
Zaratkar.
Zaratkar, who's an assistant professor at McMaster University, and she and her colleagues have published a really beautiful study with the title called Grilling the Data: Application of a Specification Curve Analysis to Red Meat and All-Cause Mortality. And I know this specification curve analysis is kind of a jargony term, but we're going to explain why this is such an important paper. So welcome, Dina.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
All right, well, tell us a brief summary of the sort of top line results of the study, and then we'll get into the details.
If I were to summarize the paper in two sentences, I would say that the results of observational studies, particularly nutritional epidemiology studies, are contingent on their analytic choices. And even experienced investigators would often disagree about the optimal approach for analyzing data from these studies.
So that is amazing. When we have an observational study, this case it's red meat and mortality, but it could be blueberries and stroke, or it could be quinoa and this or that, or whatever kind of association study. Whenever we read a paper like that, we always read the methods section, and the authors will say, we analyze the data using whatever Cox proportional hazards or Poisson or and we use these variants, and we adjusted in this way. But it's always one way, isn't it?
Exactly. It's usually one way, maybe a handful of sensitivity analyses, but really that's just a tiny, tiny fraction of what is actually possible and a small fraction of what is potentially defensible and justifiable, for analyzing the data.
Okay, and so what exactly is this specification curve analysis? My simple understanding of it is it's just a way to analyze a data set in many different ways, but tell us more.
Specification curve analysis, I'll call it multiverse analysis because one, multiverse analysis seems more interesting, and two, because it may be more accessible to your listeners. So it's a new analytic method that involves defining and implementing all plausible and valid approaches, analytic approaches for addressing a research question. And then drawing inferences using the distribution of results from all these possible analytic approaches. And this is in contrast to what you described as the conventional method of analyzing data, where we typically do one primary analysis and maybe a handful of sensitivity analyses. So instead of just doing one analysis and a handful of sensitivity analyses, we consider all the possible ways that could justifiably be used to analyze the data, to answer a single question, and then we look at the distribution of results across all of these analyses to draw inferences.
So in your paper, you just don't make up all of these different analytic methods. You have a specific way to identify these methods, right? Because you used a big systematic review that had 15 different studies. Is that right? And is that how you went about sort of choosing the different plausible methods?
A limitation of multiverse analysis, people will say, okay, well, how do we know what is valid? How do we know what is actually justifiable? So, to get around this issue, what we did was we took a systematic review that had addressed the question of the effects of red meat on all-cause mortality, and we reviewed all the primary studies included in this review. So I think it was 15 publications and 24 studies. And then we documented all the different ways that these published studies had gone about answering the question of the effect of red meat on all-cause mortality. And So in summary, what we found is that people were using very different methods to address this question. So there was a lot of inconsistency in the methods that investigators were using. And the benefit of doing this is that these aren't, just marginally defensible approaches. These are approaches that, have gone through peer review and have been published. So these are, valid and justifiable.
When you say different methods, just pretend we don't know anything. Like what are we talking about with different methods?
So one example would be the type of analytic model that we use. So some nutritional epidemiology studies will use, for example, Cox proportional hazards model. Others will actually just use simple logistic regression. Another problem is our choice of covariates. So our understanding of complex biomedical questions and environmental questions is very, very limited. And so we are not always aware of all the confounders that may be at play, and how do we actually select the variables that we include in our model to adjust for confounders? And everybody has very different opinions about what is a confounding factor, what could be mediating the association, and so on. And so what you find when you actually go through these studies, that all studies are adjusting for a different set of variables. Other analytic methods would be how we choose to deal with missing data. Do we impute the data? If we do impute the data, what method do we use to impute the data? If we don't, do we use complete case? How do we go about it?
I think in the supplement you had a table with a different analytic with the different covariates, and I was just struck by how many different things you could decide to control for. I mean, age and sex and socioeconomic status. I mean, it's just the tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely. And I think we did an analysis where we looked at, the number of studies that had adjusted for each covariate, and the median number of studies that had adjusted for each covariate was just one. So considering this inconsistency in choice of covariates, then the question really becomes, are any of these studies actually adequately adjusting for confounding? And I think I would say no.
Yeah. And the other, okay, so let's move on. So you have this systematic review. It has published studies. The published studies has these different methods. But then I read this thing where when you considered all of the possible choices, you end up with 10 quadrillion different analytic methods. Is that right? Or I mean, that
Yeah.
seems like a ton of ways to look at a data set.
Absolutely. And it may be hard to believe, but that is actually the number. And you may say how we came about this 10 quadrillion unique analytic methods that could possibly be applied. And how we came about it is by using the different combinations of choices that the primary studies made, right? So for example, a study could use a Cox proportional hazards model or a logistic regression. And then the next decision would be, okay, well, do they adjust for BMI or do they not adjust for BMI? And so it's sort of branching out, and across all these decisions, eventually you end up with with 10 quadrillion possible analyses.
Because you have to raise each choice up to at the exponent, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then you can't possibly, even with computing power that we have today, you couldn't possibly do 10 quadrillion analysis. So how did you decide on narrowing it down?
Yeah, so it's impossible to do 10 quadrillion analyses, of course. And so we just picked a random sample of the analyses. I think it was about 1200 unique analyses that we did. And because the selection is random, we would expect that the distribution would be similar to had we ever been able to run 10 quadrillion analyses.
And so for the specific research question of red meat and mortality, what does this 1200 different analyses come up with?
Yeah, so across the 1200 unique analyses that we performed, the hazard ratios for the effect of red meat on all-cause mortality ranged from 0.51 to 1.75. The median hazard ratio was 0.94, and the interquartile range was between 0.83 to 1.05, suggesting red meat to have little or no effect on all-cause mortality. And of all these specifications that we did, very few, about 5%, were actually statistically significant. And this is the number that you would actually expect to be statistically significant just by chance alone, right?
Right, because of, I didn't even think of that, right? So the p value 0.05 is sort of that tail end of the curve, and you basically found 4 or 5% of them that had statistically significant results, but most of them were darn smack in the middle of no
Exactly.
effect.
Exactly. But you get a different picture when you read the primary studies that have been published, right? You see a lot of statistically significant effects, most of them suggesting that red meat is indeed very harmful to your health.
Wow. So, this is such an unusual paper. I look at a lot of papers, I read a lot of observational studies, but I don't see investigators taking the time to do 1,200 different analyses, which is actually a random sample of 10 quadrillion different ways to analyze the data. How did this idea, this paper come about? I mean, there must be a story.
There is. So, this idea came about from my time as a doctoral student and actually from my doctoral thesis. So, for clinical practice guidelines and public health guidelines, like dietary guidelines, to be considered credible, we know that they have to adhere to certain standards. Like they have to, for example, limit and manage conflicts of interest. They have to be based on comprehensive and rigorous systematic reviews of the evidence. But what the evidence actually shows is that few published dietary guidelines actually adhere to these standards. So during my PhD, in response to this evidence, we organized an international consortium to develop, what we consider to be credible and trustworthy dietary recommendations. And we called this initiative NutriRex. Now, you may recall the first NutriRex guideline addressed the topic of red meat consumption. It was very, very controversial, but to inform these guidelines, what we actually did is we did systematic reviews of the evidence. So we looked at 12 randomized trials with nearly 50,000 participants and 178 cohort studies with over 15 million participants. And in reviewing all of this evidence, a lot of it from observational nutritional epidemiology studies, I realized that these studies have formidable limitations. Very, very big, big, big limitations, some challenges that are very impossible to overcome. And so one of these is analytic flexibility, which eventually gave rise to this study.
And how would you say the implications are for this? Because I'm thinking we constantly read, well, let's just start A with nutritional epidemiology, and then maybe move on to other areas of observational research. But I mean, there aren't many papers like this. And how would a reader, when we read a study that shows some association with some nutritional how would we approach that given this work that you've done?
Yeah, so I think for epidemiologists, multiverse analysis or specification curve analysis can address a critical issue, analytic flexibility. So it can help investigators draw more credible inferences that aren't necessarily contingent on arbitrary analytic choices. And it also reduces the opportunity for investigators to conduct many different analyses and then selectively report results for the analyses that yield the most interesting results, the most publishable results, the results that are more likely to get into journals like JAMA or NEJM, what we call selective reporting in research.
Dina, that would never happen. I'm certain that would never happen.
We can dream, we can dream.
Well, okay, but how hard would it be for I can imagine there's a PhD student at a university, and he or she has a project and they want to review NHANES data, or they want to review this data or that data, and they actually do 1,200 analyses like you did? I mean, this looks like a big project to me.
Yes and no. It does take more work than a typical, run-of-the-mill observational study. But it is feasible, and we show that it is feasible. You can do it. And nowadays we have great computers where anybody can really do this type of analysis if they wanted to. I think the biggest challenge, though, is making multiverse analysis more palatable. So investigators often favor their preferred method for data analysis. And every time I speak about this study, folks say, well, Dana, surely one of these ways is more correct than the other. That's not really the case, right? Like, what is evident, what we actually show in the study, is that investigators are addressing the same or very similar questions using very different analytic methods. So for multiverse analysis to be useful, investigators have to acknowledge the subjectivity in their analytic choices, which I think is the biggest challenge.
So,
The feasibility, the computational power is really secondary to that.
see, that's surprising to me because I would just look at this as an outsider, not knowing anything about how you would go about this analysis, thinking that it was really hard to do. But you actually think that it's just more a subjective bias of what a top people think is the right way to do it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, I mean, I'm not saying that it's easy to do. It's just it's a little bit of extra work in the grand scheme of things.
And let me push you to say, does this apply at all, or could we apply this multiverse, this many analytic method way of approaching other kinds of observational studies that are, say, outside the realm of nutritional epidemiology? I mean, cardiology, my field, has a ton of association studies. Would the same flexibility of analytic choices and implications of your study have similar, adaptations there?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think this can apply really in any field where there are observational studies. I will say, though, that specifically nutritional epidemiology is a very challenging field, and nutritional epidemiology studies themselves have what I would expect is probably more analytic flexibility than other types of observational studies, but I think the same principles apply. There's analytic flexibility in all observational studies, and to an extent, even randomized trials. And so the same principles and theories would apply.
Well, let me just push you on the randomized trials, because the impression there is that a randomized trial is pre-registered. People are saying that we're going to do this, we're going to do it this way, and we're going to analyze it that way. And but you think there's still flexibility in RCTs? Tell me more.
To a small degree, to a much, much smaller degree than observational studies, of course. Now, we hope that randomized trials are pre-registered before, the first patient is even recruited and they have detailed statistical analysis plans. But when you do systematic reviews like I do, you realize that not all randomized trials are actually pre-registered, and even fewer of them have detailed statistical analysis plans before they go about analyzing the data. So, to an extent, it still does apply to randomized trials. I mean, we still see reanalyses of randomized trials that sometimes yield conclusions that are different from the primary analysis. But definitely to observational studies in any field, I think this is important.
So let's conclude. You're an assistant professor at McMaster, and what exactly is your field of expertise? And maybe tell us what the next project or next things you're working on are.
Yeah, so I'm an assistant professor at McMaster. I do a lot of evidence synthesis and evaluation. You may ask what that is. So people all over the world are doing a lot of research addressing important health questions, but these studies often produce conflicting findings or published faster than evidence users, that clinicians can really read them and make sense of them. And they come with strengths and limitations that may not be immediately apparent. So I take these studies, I evaluate their quality, and I try to use them to optimally inform healthcare and public health decisions. So I do this by systematic reviews, meta-analyses, guidelines. And I also do some research on methods to advance evidence synthesis and evaluation. In terms of what's next for me, I mean, I'll focus on multiverse analysis. So this was a sort of a proof of concept study showing that multiverse analysis is feasible to do, and I think in the future it could be applied to address substantive questions of high interest to the scientific community. There are also ways in which multiverse analysis can be further refined for broader application. So, for example, in practice, there's subjectivity in deciding which approaches are justifiable and valid, and we went about that by using published studies, but another way you could go about that is doing surveys with investigators and analysts to sort of solicit them for what they think is defensible and justifiable, and then implementing those analytic methods. So I think that would be a nice extension to multiverse analysis.
And final question. You found in this multiverse analysis, when you look at all the different analytic methods of red meat and mortality, you basically found no significant effect. When Brian Nosek looked at the social science question of red cards and European referees, basically found fairly strong effects around the null. Do you worry that when we do proper multiverse analysis is specification curve analysis, when we look at a data set in many different ways, we may find that the results aren't so exciting. Or do you think that by doing this multiverse kind of look at things, we may find signals from noise? I mean, or do you not know?
I will say I don't know. And I think my hypothesis is that
Yes.
multiverse analysis will push us to make more conservative inferences. And I think some fields, nutrition epidemiology being a case in point, can really benefit from that.
What a beautiful concluding statement. A more conservative analysis, that's approach. That is a excellent closing statement. So thank you very much for being with us. This is awesome, and I think our listeners will really like it.
Thanks, John. It's been great.
Okay. Let me